So this evening our topic is praying for the ill. Now, there are a lot of prerequisite ideas that we need to define before we go into the nitty-gritty. A word, there is a section in the Shulchan Aruch which talks about how to do Bikur Cholim. That's how to, well, we generally translate the phrase Bikur Cholim, we translate it to mean visiting the sick. Technically speaking, that's an inaccurate translation, because Bikur comes from the word Bikoret. And Bikoret means to check. It doesn't mean to visit. When we visit the sick, what we're supposed to do is really check to see how they're doing. If one were to visit somebody in a hospital, for example, if the person has family there, so they're actually the ones who are usually doing the checking. In other words, to make sure, is the person getting the proper care? Are the those who are caring for the individual reading the proper, you know, medicines and the chart and making sure that accurate information is being put in? It's a person who's ill and incapacitated in whatever way may not necessarily be able to be an advocate for oneself. So it's the responsibility of those who check on the person to see how they're doing, to make sure that they're actually, things are being done correctly. As a matter of fact, I didn't put it here, but in source number 4, before the Gemara which I gave you, there's a tale about Rabbi Akiva, that Rabbi Akiva went to visit a student of his who was very ill. And the Gemara tells us that others had neglected to check in on this individual. Rabbi Akiva came in and he cared for him. He opened the window, he swept out the dust, whatever it was, and the person woke up, or somehow, you know, was aware that it was his own Rebbe, Rabbi Akiva, who was caring for him, who had come to see, he would come to check to see if he was doing okay. And the person got better, and when he did get better, he came back to Rabbi Akiva and he said, "Rebbe, it was on account of what you did that I got better, because it's one thing, you know, everybody could pray for me, that's great, but if you don't actually come and check to see how a person is doing, then you're not necessarily going to do all that you can for the individual." So when it comes to Bikur Cholim, and that's also a point which I want to take into account, let's actually take a look at source number 7. Source number 7 is the episode, we just read this on Pesach, it's the tale, right, leading up to the splitting of the sea. So, you know, people are coming to Moshe and they're saying, "Moshe, what are we going to do? The Egyptians are chasing after us. What are we to do?" So Moshe turns to God and he says, "Well, what should we do?" And Vayomer Hashem al Moshe, in source number 7, Shmos Yudalid, Pasuk Tezvav, 14:15. Vayomer Hashem Moshe, God says to Moshe, "Matitzake lai, what are you screaming at me for? Dabrel ben Yisrael v'yisod. Talk to the people and go." Thank you very much, but there's a sea in front of us. What are we supposed to do? So God says, "Well, pick up your staff and split the sea." That's what's supposed to take place at this moment. So it's on those words, "Matitzake lai," what are you screaming at me? And God says to Moshe, "What are you screaming at me for?" So Rashi has this comment. He says, "Lamanu shaya Moshe omeinu mispalel." We learned that Moshe was standing and praying. He's davening. Amar lo Kadosh Baruch Hu, lo eis ata la'arich b'tfila, she Yisrael nusunim batzara. He says, "Now's not the time, Moshe, to have a long Shmon Esrei." Okay? Now's not the time to have a lengthy davening. You got to take action. So when it comes to the concept of Bikur Cholim, when a person, see here in Moshe's case, the entire nation was Bitzara. They had a difficult situation. They were being pursued by the Egyptians on the one hand, and then on the other hand, they've got a sea which they can't cross because it's impossible. So Moshe's davening, he's davening, he's davening. God says, "Look, there's a time and place for everything. Sometimes davening is important, and sometimes actually taking action is also important." And in that particular case, Moshe had to take action. He had to take his stick. So when it comes to the concept of Bikur Cholim, you know, we can all pray all we want from wherever we may be. We can pray. You could pray at home. You could pray in shul. You could pray wherever you may be. You could think about a person when you're in the car. whatever, wherever it is that you're doing. You know, when you bake your challah on Shabbos, for Shabbos, when you bake your challah, you say, oh, this so-and-so who is ill always bakes challah, I'm having her in mind. You know, whatever it is that you're doing. So-and-so, oh, he's always participating in he always comes to the Wednesday night shir, and he's not here, so let's have him in mind. So, in other words, to have a person in mind, we can always do, but to take action, that is a key and critical element, which we learn from Rabbi Akiva, which we learn from Moshe over here, and which we'll also see, you know, thrown in subtle ways in the other things which we're going to see. Okay, so we see that there's two elements to praying for the ill. On the one hand, there's the actual tefillah, which we'll get to. And on the other hand, there is taking action when it comes to Bikur Cholim. As I mentioned before, not in this recording for those who are listening, but as I mentioned before we started, that the Shulchan Aruch has Hilchos Bikur Cholim, and I gave a lot of it. I cut it. It's in Yoredei Shin Lamed Hei, 335 through 339. Its sources 8 and 9 on the sheets here, which we're obviously not going to go through because there's a ton of material here. So one of these simanim, it's the last one, Shin Lamed Tes, which actually talks about how to pray on behalf of those who are ill. Okay, but before we do that, we have to define what it means somebody who is ill. So I remember a number of years ago, I was in shul, and there was a guy who came to shul. He had a baby who was a year old. Now his kid, I think, had a cold or a cough. And it came time to do the Misha Berach, and he includes his child's name on there. Okay, now, children get sick maybe 10, 20 times in a year, okay? And they, thank God, you know, usually get better all the time. And I've spoken to doctors who said it's actually important for them to get sick in that way. It helps them build their immune system, so it's all a good thing. Now, when a child gets a cold or a runny nose or a cough, is that person considered sick? I mean, we may technically say the person's sick, but the person is not constituted as a chole, as one who is ill to the point that they need to be included in the mishaber. Now, if a father in that type of situation says, "Oh, God, will you please, you know, help my child get better?" Okay, so the father can certainly do that if he will. But to include the person in a Misha Berach or in a public prayer for the ill, it's the wrong time and place, because somebody in that type of circumstance is not what we would constitute as being sick. A number of years ago, a lot of my anecdotes from a number of years ago, actually it was last year, I published an opinion piece in a Jewish newspaper about the Misha Berach. And the focus of that, I'm going to share with you my opinion with regard to that, and the direction of that article, and how it doesn't so much play into our topic tonight, but how it's somewhat relevant. The question about the Misha Berach for Cholim, the public one, which is done in the shul. So my argument basically is that, you know, in some places they'll have a Misha Berach and they're going to have lists and lists and lists, 10, 20, 30, 50 people, because everybody, you know, every Tom, Dick, and Harry and Lorraine, Shirley, and whatever, they all have people who they know. I mean, unfortunately, you know, that there are people who are not well. Fortunately, we know so many people, and there are so many people who we would like to include in our prayers. And so they put them on the list. Now, when I was in yeshiva in Israel, they used to have a Misha Berach list, and they would replace it. Thank you. They would replace it every week. Okay, Saturday night, they would get rid of the one that they had that they used on Shabbos, and they say, okay, if you have a chola, if you have an ill person, you want to put them on the list, so you can put them on the list. But this way, you know, I have some people, they carry a list and they use the same list forever. I'm always nervous when I see a rabbi's list that he's reading from, and half the names are crossed out. You know, you wonder, when half the names are crossed out, you wish that he would just make up a new list, because when you see names crossed out, you don't know, did they get better? And that's why he's not praying with them anymore? Or, you know, so you don't know, right? So, I mean, a nice story is, I remember a few years ago, and I was still living in Lawrence, so there was an Ufruf in the shul, and the rabbi got up and he said, not all of you know this young man, but when I tell you his Hebrew name, and he mentioned his Hebrew name, you're all going to recognize. And the truth is that it was true, because the young man, when he was in high school, he had contracted leukemia, and everybody had been praying for him. He had been on on the cholel list for a long time. I'm sure there were some people who were still praying for him when he was, at this point, thank God, fine. But the point is that everybody knew his name because of the circumstance. Now, somebody with leukemia, and say, you can certainly pray for that on that person's behalf. So then, okay, so getting back to the articles, the question was, is it appropriate to include every person that you know on this Misha Berach list? So then it goes back to the question of what is a chola. So we're going to get to that answer in a moment. The point that I made is, look, you want to pray for everybody that you know, that's fine. But there's another consideration when there's a Misha Berach, and that is, it's not fair to every person in the room that they have to go through the 50. I mean, sometimes you really have a list of 100 people. So my argument was that for the public Misha Berach, we should limit it to the people who we all know, perhaps members of a shul, right? We can even announce, we're praying for Mr. So-and-so, Mrs. So-and-so, our good friend and neighbor who is afflicted with this, who is in this type of situation. And there, everybody cares about the person, and that's totally appropriate. But for everyone else to hear every name who they have no connection to, it's perhaps not appropriate in the context of a shul where you have what's called tircha d'tzibura, where people are being delayed, so to speak, on account. That's not that they don't care about the person who you're praying for, but it's just that there are other considerations to consider when we're in the synagogue. And the other element of the argument is not that we shouldn't pray for them, but every person, if you have a list of people, we can add them into our own personal prayers on a daily basis, three times a day. We say Shemona Esrei, and in Shemona Esrei there's a bracha, Rifa Einu. Rifa Einu means heal us. And in that bracha, there's a supplement that a person can add saying, God, will you please heal all the people in my life who I'm concerned about? And it's personal, and it's meaningful, and it's a lot more often than the public Misha Berach, which is at most three times a week, in some cases only once a week. Now, if the shul has the thing where they say, okay, we're now going to pause, as we do here on Shabbos, we're now going to pause and you can insert whatever name, so then insert whoever you want, that's fine. You can insert your 50 names if you will. Okay, so now that gets back to our question, what constitutes a chola, a sick person, for whom we are going to pray? So let us, if you're following along, you can look in sources numbers 5 and 6. Okay? It's on the first page. So, the Chasam Sofer on the Gemara in Gittin, he says, you know, sometimes when people pray, so he actually quotes a controversial idea, which was proposed by the Maharil, who said, the Maharil wrote that one should not bless a chola, in other words, pray on behalf of a chola, a sick person, when not in the same city, because you don't know if the person has died or gotten better, which would render it what he calls a tefillah shav. In other words, if you're in town, you know, you just visited the person, so you can come to the shul and pray on that person's behalf, that's appropriate. Now again, this is controversial, not everybody agrees, and the Chasam Sofer even says that not everybody agrees with that. Because, and he continues, right, on the one hand, you don't want to say a false prayer, you don't want to say, please heal so-and-so, when so-and-so is either better already, or so-and-so is unfortunately deceased. So you don't want to do that unless you know for sure that the person obviously needs it. That was the Maharil suggestion. Others disagree, because a person has a chazakah for being alive, but not for being sick, a status which changes all the time. In other words, it's not a false prayer to pray, you know, please watch over so-and-so. Let's say the person is better. So is that a tefillah shav, a useless prayer? No, it's not. Everybody could use prayer all the time. We don't want somebody to get sick. Please watch over so-and-so is an appropriate prayer at any time for somebody who's alive. It's not appropriate if somebody is no longer alive, but it is appropriate if somebody's alive, whether sick or not sick. And those who argue against the Maharil say, look, the bottom line is that people get sick all the time. And usually, they get better. If a person gets sick 100 times in their life, and they heal 99 of those times, well, guess what? 99 out of 100 times, they get better. So we have, generally speaking, a chazakah. It's an established, not fact, obviously it's not every time, but most times, well, every time in a person's lifetime, they get better. So, think about it. Okay? So it's generally speaking the case that a person who has been sick can certainly use the prayers because we don't assume that the person has died. The last line in source number 5, V'lo nikra chole, ela miyom gimel v'chol ashtel k'mevor b'Yerushalmi. See, he quotes the Gemara in Yerushalmi. I couldn't find the Gemara in Yerushalmi, which is why I didn't bring the Gemara. But he says, when is a person sick? So let's use my friend who prayed on behalf of his baby, okay? As I mentioned at the outset. So his baby got sick yesterday. So he comes into shul today, and he says, my child has an illness. Okay. So, guess what? It hasn't been 3 days. So if it hasn't been 3 days, right, somebody, what do you have, a 24-hour virus, 24-hour flu? People, it happens all the time. You get a runny nose, and you know after 2 days, okay, I'm past the hump, I'm getting better. So, are you considered sick? So first of all, there needs to be a three-day, you know, litmus test. That's number one. But what else is there? So now we look at the Chayei Adam. Chayei Adam was a classic halachic work written by Rabbi Avram Danzig of Vilna in the last basically 200 years or so. So it wasn't written in the last, it was written, you know, around 200 years ago. So he says, so he, in the context of talking about the rules regarding who says Birchas HaGomel. Okay, so Birchas HaGomel, there are four categories of people who say Birchas HaGomel, and there are other types of situations. But essentially, the four categories are people who cross the sea, people who cross the desert, somebody who was ill and got better, and somebody who comes out of prison. Those are the four categories. So with regard to somebody who was ill and got better, so he goes into the definition of what does it mean that somebody was ill and got better, and therefore he's defining for us what it means that somebody got ill. So take a look at the last two lines. Aval al hamichushin. He got michush arush. But sometimes the sickness which goes away, such as a headache, uchayotzebo, rak she'eno choli hakolel kologuf, eno mavarech. So somebody who had some type of affliction which didn't affect their entire body, that's certainly somebody who breaks an arm, somebody who breaks a leg. You can say, you know, we hope you heal soon, but that person isn't considered to be sick. Somebody who gets migraines. Okay, but the migraines, they go away, they pass. Now, if they're eternal migraines and they always have a migraine, that's something else. That's something which is all the time. But somebody who is not afflicted in their entire body is not somebody who's considered ill. Go to the next side of the page. The person has to have been confined to a bed. If a person's in their house and they're walking around and they're watching TV and they're reading books and they're answering the telephone, they're basically just saying, okay, look, I'm in the house because I shouldn't really be going out. But if they're not really, you know, but if they're not confined to the bed and they can do everything else, so are they considered sick? So, I mean, I would say that it really depends on what the illness is. Meaning, does a person have to be so sick that they're confined to their bed? Let's say a person has the mumps. Vaccines for these types of things these days. Let's say a person has the mumps, but they can walk around. So I would say no. I mean, if a person could theoretically, if untreated, could die from it, I mean, thank God we have wonderful medicine these days, and people, you know, most types of diseases, except for the ones which we all, you know about, which with the terrible names that we're familiar with, but most those old school diseases that could theoretically kill somebody, nowadays, thank God, a person can get better from with proper care and medication. So, but if untreated, the person could die. Mm-hmm. So I'd say that person is chola. That person certainly can, falls under the rubric of somebody who could be prayed for and is worthy and deserving of a prayer. Not to say that others aren't, but it's not as pressing to pray on behalf of those who have those illnesses. Which, if you don't treat a cold, it's going to go away, right? Agreed? If you don't treat a cough, it'll go. In some cases, I'm not going to go into the flu pneumonia type of question, but there are some things where if you don't treat it, but you take care of yourself in a proper way, you drink plenty of fluids, whatever it is, it may take a little longer, but it will go away. I'm not speaking from medical opinion. Go to a doctor. But the bottom line is that, you know, we know how to care for things which aren't necessarily, life-threatening, thank you. So proceed with caution in terms of defining the person as a whole. Again, personal private prayers, trying to say that three times fast, okay, are always okay, but at the same time, we have to recognize what's the difference between somebody who is ill and somebody who just has a passing something or other, which will go away on its own. Okay. So now that we've defined the ill, and now that we understand who can use prayers the most, so we understand about people who have something which, if treated right, or if with God's help, obviously, it can pass. So we know who to include in our prayers. So yes.
Can I just say
something? Sure.
Okay. Because I've been confronted with this. I know someone, a child who has cancer, and so thank God she's had treatment, and so now she's better. But she, you know, this whole next year is still critical. Mm-hmm. You know, I wasn't sure when to stop.
We're going to get to it.
Okay.
So I mean, just to bring a couple of examples, though, I'm going to get to that particular type of situation. So let's say somebody who is older and frail, just on account of old age. Okay. So is it appropriate to pray, for example, for that person to get a refuah shlema, a complete healing? So I would say that the answer, I mean, to put it in those terms, it's probably inappropriate, because the bottom line is the person is not going to become unfrail. The person is not going to become unold. Right? These are things, it's just life. Now, to say, may the person have an easier life, that's fine. But to say that the person should have a refuah shleima, the person is not going to have a refuah shleima. Let's say a person has Alzheimer's disease. Awful thing, right? To pray that the person has a refuah shleima, there's no cure for Alzheimer's. Nobody who gets Alzheimer's gets better. Yet. I mean, we could pray that they could find a cure. Right. So pray that the researchers should find a cure for Alzheimer's. That's something else. But to say that this person should get a refuah shleima, based on everything that we know, that's not going to happen. Okay, if a person has, and I don't want to use other examples of diseases, but any type of thing which there's no cure for, and the person doesn't get better. So to pray that person gets a refuah shleima is perhaps inappropriate. To pray that God should have mercy on that person and give that person less suffering, that's something else, and that is appropriate. But to pray for a refuah shleima for somebody who's not going to have a refuah shleima is perhaps going into the area of what we call tefillah shav, an unnecessary prayer. Yes, sir?
Yeah, because I had somebody that told me that somebody was very sick, and they're like,
Yeah, let me get to that also. Okay. I did prepare well. I didn't organize it, but I prepared well. Okay. So let's go into a different perspective, and that is, now we're talking about praying for the ill. The question is prayer really appropriate? Now, Gemara tells us that there's a pasuk that says "Virapo yirape," that the doctor will heal. And the Gemara tells us, "Mikan nitan rishus lerofe lerapos," right? That because God said, using a double language, that rapo yirape, so doctors have permission to heal somebody. Well, you have I think it's the Christian, the Scientologists or whatever it is, and very devout, extremely religious sects of some religions who believe that whatever happens, you're not allowed to take medicine, you're not allowed to see a doctor, this is God's will.
Christian Scientologists,
right.
No, very big.
I think it's both, though.
Yeah, but Christian Scientists.
Christian Scientists and Scientologists also. So is that appropriate? So from a Jewish perspective, it's completely inappropriate. Okay, we go to doctors. So if you go to a doctor, So that means that you're allowed to use the science of the world in order to help a person get healed. Now, what about those who say, no, I'm only relying on God. So in other words, I'm going to pray. So there's an interesting Gemara. So the Gemara tells us, this is source number one in Shavuos, that says, Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi says, Asur l'hisra pos b'divrei Torah, that a person cannot be healed through words of Torah. In other words, I can't go over to a person who is sick and read a Mishnah or a Gemara or a Chumash over them and say, "Ah, I did it, and now the person is going to be healed." That's like heebie-jeebie mumbo-jumbo. Okay, and the Gemara says, you're not allowed to do that. But the Gemara says, well, hold on, lahagi and shani, that to protect somebody, however, is different, and that's permissible. Ve'ela ki amar asur, however, no, wait a second, it said asur, it's forbidden. He says, "De'ika maka." He says, "When is it forbidden to do that? In other words, to to assume that your words of Torah are going to heal the person and therefore it is forbidden when a person is afflicted with something. So if it's when a person is afflicted that it's prohibited, so what do you mean lahagin, to protect, is seems to be permitted? That's not heebie-jeebie. So somebody who says words over somebody who's afflicted has no share in the world to come. You have no share in the world to come if you're going to do this heebie-jeebie saying words of Torah over somebody who's ill. So he says, "Ha'itmar Allah, Amar Rabbi Yochanan, Barokik Shana Lufisha Ein Maskirin Shem Shemaim Ala Rekika." He says, "When is it forbidden to the point that a person has no share in the world to come? Barokik. If somebody does heebie-jeebie and spits, if you're going to say words of Torah and go spit over it, now you're really getting into heebie-jeebie." Then you have no share in the world to come. However, if you're just going to say words of Torah, then he says it's forbidden, but it's not that you don't have a share in the world to come. So wait a second. But we said that lahagein shani, the protect over somebody is different. Okay, so Tosfos addresses that, and he quotes the Gemara in Brachos, and we're just going to focus on the last two words. He says for somebody who has like a fever of a day in ishtabas yoma, he says sakanta shani, that when a person is in danger, then it is different. So what do we mean? What it means is that if a person is, as I presented it, if a person is going to come along and say, "I am going to say words of Torah because words of Torah are so powerful, they're going to make you better." So that type of attitude, as the Rambam says in the next source which I gave you, I'm sorry, is it the Rambam? Yes, it's the Rambam. He says that anybody who's going to do that, I'm not going to read it inside, but anybody who does that is like a koker, somebody who has denied God, because they're basically, I mean, he uses the word menachashim v'chovrim, they're like necromancers who are assuming that their words and what they're doing bring about the healing. And the Rambam says this is a tremendous problem, because what they are doing is, I'm in the middle of the whole section there, so of source number two, he says, Shehein osin divrei Torah refuas guf. They're assuming that words of Torah are healers of a body. Ve'einan ela refuas nefashos. Words of Torah are only healing for the soul. Shenemar v'ayu chayim l'nafshecha, that they'll bring life to your soul. Okay, aval habari shekar psukin u'mizmor mitehilim kedei shetagein alav zuchus kriyasan v'yinatzel mitzaros v'yinatzel mitzaros. He says, however, if a well person wants to say Tehillim, wants to learn, so that the merit of my Torah learning, or the things which I'm saying, should protect me, or should protect somebody else, or the merit of these words should be a zechus for somebody, to help them get better. It's not that the Torah words themselves are the medicine, or the healing, but that, and this is what we say all the time, we say, I'm dedicating this class in the merit that so and so should have a refuah shleima. I dedicate this class in the merit that so and so's neshama should have an aliyah. Right? In other words, it's that we're getting points for the things which we're doing, not that we're assuming that our words or the things which we're saying are actually healing. Okay, so let's bear that in mind, that distinction, because you know you'll say, wait a second, people say Tehillim all the time. Yes, and the Rambam is clearly saying Tehillim is appropriate. But we have to recognize what mindset we're supposed to have when we're saying this. We're not saying our words are healing the person. That's witchcraft. We don't believe that. We believe that our words are bringing merits, earning points, so that those points, those merits, can help a person in whatever way God runs his world. And that is appropriate. Now, there are a number of tales in the Gemara of people who were sick, and on account of their illness, there are those who prayed either on their behalf and they got better, or prayed on their behalf so that their lives should end. Okay, we're going to get to that in a moment. Let's just take a look at source number four. A lot of people who, sources who refer to the concept of praying on behalf of the ill, refer to this Gemara. But of course, source number four, Nedarim Mem Amud Aleph, 40a. This Gemara, it's in the context of Bikur Cholim that the Gemara talks about. In other words, what we, you know, we usually call visiting the sick, which we define at the beginning as checking on the sick, in which the Gemara tells us the rules of engagement when it comes to visiting those who are ill, and why it's so important actually to do Bikur Cholim more than just having a list. Okay, let's read through this Gemara. It's a very important, significant Gemara. Kiyasa Rav Dimi says, and there's more to it than just this. I would encourage you to read the entire Gemara, but we're gonna read this entire box. But there's obviously more to the Gemara in the Talmud itself. Kiyasa Rav Dimi, when he arrived and he participated in the conversation that they were having, he said, Amar kol mevaker sachol goren lo sheyichya. Anybody who comes and checks on the ill will cause them to live. Somebody who does not come to check on the ill will cause them to death. Will cause them to die. My grandma, what do you mean, will cause them? If I come, a person's going to get better, and if I don't come, they're going to die? That's ridiculous. We don't believe that. Elema, he says, so what did he mean? What he meant is, somebody who comes to check on the ill, mevakesh alav rachamim sheyichya, will see the person's condition, will feel the person's plight, and will be moved to actually beseech God, help this person, heal this person, take care of this person. And anybody who does not come to visit or see or check on the sick person is requesting essentially mercy that the person should die. What do you mean? If a person doesn't come, he's asking that the person, is that person really requesting that from God that the ill person should die? Ella, rather, if you don't come to check and see the person who's ill, you're not going to be moved either to request that the person should live or that the person should die. In other words, you're doing nothing. Just because you know the person's ill, it doesn't have the same value to yourself as an individual when you don't actually see the person and feel their pain and their suffering. When you see somebody and you see a tube stuck in the, you know, in here and a you know, whatever it is, an IV over here and needle stuck in and everything touched, or even not in a hospital, just in their bed and they're just and they're cracking and they're really in pain and they're suffering. You feel their pain and you say, oh God, Rabbeinu Shalom, no matter what you're going to say, God, I really wish that you would be better. And you really mean it in a much different way than when you know, oh, you know, so-and-so's sick and they're at home and I just sent the chicken soup and now I'm going to pray on their behalf. Because there's no ein adomish mi'alariya. You can't compare hearing whatever you know about the person to when you actually see it. When you see it, you see what the person's feeling and you're moved to help them. Rava yoma kadama dechalish amar lohun lo tigul inish. So the Gemara tells a tale about Rava. I'll just tell you this one inside. Rava, before he would get sick, or when he got sick, he would say to the people around him, listen, don't tell anybody yet that I'm sick. Okay? Because he didn't want the word to get out. Because, who knows, it could be a one-day, two-day sickness, right? However, if it was 3 days and it would extend, Rava said, okay, now I'm ill, go out into the marketplace and tell everybody that I'm sick. And this way, it'll be to my benefit. And he says, he has a very interesting idea. He says, because those who hate me will be happy. This is, I'm going to actually talk about this on Shabbos, because there's a pasuk in Mishlei which says, "Bin pol oyivcha al tismach." Right, when your enemy falls, don't rejoice. And Rava's feeling was, if those who hate me will hear that I'm happy, that I'm sick, and they'll be happy, well, maybe the fact that they're not doing what they're supposed to be doing will be a merit for me, and I'll get better. Okay, because they're going to be happy, so I'll get better. And those who like me will pray on my behalf. So hopefully, I'll get the enemies working in my you know, in a roundabout way on my behalf, and those who like me also praying on my behalf. Okay, so but here again, the point to pull out of this Gemara is that there is so much more to be said about seeing a person and therefore being moved to pray on their behalf than just hearing about them. Now, obviously, in some circumstances, you can't see the person. Right? Let's say they're in an intensive care unit, you can't see them. Let's say they don't want visitors, you can't see them. Let's say it's too unsightly, and their family is protecting them, saying, you know, it's not appropriate for you to see them. I mean, just to bring an example, a personal example, my grandmother, who you know, passed away earlier this year. So I the last time I saw her was before she had gone into the bed, which ended up being her deathbed. And she was sitting in a room, and she was, you know, I talked to her. And then I left, and a few days later she went into that bed, which was served as her deathbed. So it was 2 weeks from when she got into that bed till she actually passed away. So I was on the phone with my mother, and I said, should I come and visit? My mother said, why don't you remember her the way that you saw her last? You don't want to see this. And my siblings who were there, and I was actually just talking to my great aunt who you know, her sister, and she said, she described to me what you sometimes don't want to see. And in that case, of course, in other words, to pray that she get better, she wasn't going to be getting better. That it was known. So, you just pray that the person, that the suffering ends. And that's, in that case, what we did. And I don't have any of those images, thank God, in my head. And I think that I'm personally better for it, on the one hand. And at the same time, as my mother, who's her daughter, said, you know, this is not a place for you to be. You don't want to see this. So, however she described it. Okay, so, anyway, that's another possibility. But if in the event that it's at least possible to be present in whatever way it's permissible, it's better than I would suggest that on the one hand it's better than just sitting in your home and not doing anything, because in your home if you go to a hospital, so even if you don't see the person, they're in a hospital and you're stirred, I would suggest to pray in a better way than if you're just at home. And that's why we have this concept of Bikur Cholim, and that's why the Shulchan Aruch does spend so many simanim and so many si'ifim talking about it in sources 8 and 9. Which we're probably not going to get into per se. Okay, let's turn to sources 11 and 12, in which the Gemara has these. There are two stories. These are well-known stories in the Gemara about circumstances when individuals were so sick that they needed prayers of some kind to end their suffering. Okay, and of course this is a different degree, and I'm going to get to your question before I finish, but I just wanted to address this, and that is the story of Reish Lakish and Rabbi Yochanan, and the story of Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi. So the first story is a very sad story in the Gemara, and it could be used in a number of different classes. If we were to talk about Lashon Hara, if we were to talk about sensitivity, that source number 11, the Gemara Bava Metzia, Pei Dalet, page 84, would be important. And basically what it is, look, Reish Lakish, when he grew up, he was but in his earlier adult years, he was a bandit. And to make a long story short, he at one point came across Rabbi Yochanan, and Rabbi Yochanan told him that you could repent, you have a brilliant mind, and you could become a great scholar, and you could change your way. So Reish Lakish ultimately did, and he actually married Rabbi Yochanan's sister. They became brothers-in-law, and they were tremendous friends. And at one point, they were having a debate. The Gemara talks about it. I'm not going to get into the details. Essentially, at one point in the debate between them, and they would debate all the time, Torah-wise, and loved each other for it. Rabbi Yochanan made a comment about Reish Lakish, in which he said, because Reish Lakish said something about weaponry, and Rabbi Yochanan said, somebody who's in the field knows his trade. Basically reminding Reish Lakish about his past, which he didn't want to know about. Reish Lakish made a comment to defend himself, and because Rabbi Yochanan was the senior rabbi, on account of that, I don't know if he cursed Reish Lakish, but essentially Reish Lakish became ill, and he died because of that illness. Before he died, Reish Lakish's wife, who's Rabbi Yochanan's sister, and this is where I brought the Gemara here, came over to him and said, "You're going to make your sister a widow? Forgive Reish Lakish so that he won't die." And Rabbi Yochanan said, he didn't forgive Reish Lakish, and Reish Lakish ultimately died. After Reish Lakish died, Rabbi Yochanan went into a depression. He realized that what he had done and what he had said to bring about this whole circumstance was counterproductive. He missed his friend dearly, and he wished that he had gone about it in a different way and wouldn't let his ego get in such a manner. And he became depressed, and the rabbis tried to make him feel better. They sent scholars to come and debate with Reish, not debate, but to talk Torah with Rabbi Yochanan. And when a guy would Rabbi Yochanan would make a comment, so the guy would say, "Oh, what you said is supported by so-and-so." Rabbi Yochanan was like, "Are you kidding? You're supposed to replace Reish Lakish? If I would make a comment like that, Reish Lakish would ask 24 questions on what I said to disprove my theory." And at a different time, he'd say, Rabbi Yochanan, what you said is right. And Rabbi Yochanan was like, "You're going to tell me that I'm right? I know that what I said is right." And he became even more depressed. So much so that he lost his reason. And the Gemara concludes He lost his reason. This is the last line in source 11. So the rabbis had to pray for mercy for Rabbi Yochanan because he lost it, and he died. And there's a similar story in the Gemara in Ksubos, which somehow I wrote Besubos, but it's supposed to be Ksubos in the English. I got it right, because it's Ksubos. Okay, with Rebbe, who also got to a point where he was on what was his deathbed. Now there are other places in the Gemara that say that Rebbe's being alive was a merit to the Jewish people. Rabbi Yehuda Anasi's merit, his being alive was a merit to the Jewish people. So the rabbis prayed and kept on praying to sustain Rebbe's life, even though he was suffering, even though he was in such terrible pain, because they knew that his being alive was a merit for the Jewish people. But, and there are a number of cases in the Gemara where you have a person who was called Amsei the Rebbe, a maidservant in the house of Rebbe, who knew better than the rabbis what was good for the particular circumstance, or in this case, what was good for Rebbe Yehuda Anasi. And so what she did was she realized that it was the prayer of the rabbis that was prolonging Rebbe Yehuda Anasi's suffering. And she said, this is ridiculous. You can't prolong his suffering. You got to let him go. And so she threw down a vessel of some kind which crashed and clattered and caused them to lose their concentration. They stopped praying during that moment. And the Gemara tells us during that moment, Rebbe Yehuda Anasi died and his suffering ended. So the question. So I mean, these are Gemaras which are used also in the context of the discussion about end of life questions. And I'm not going into that debate. Obviously, that's a medical ethics discussion. But I'll just tell you that there's an individual I know whose father suffered for a number of years with Alzheimer's disease, and it was absolutely. I mean, as we all know, devastating. For the family, for the son of the person afflicted, and he told me that he asked Poskim, "May I pray that my father dies?" Okay, so he was told that you can pray that your father's suffering shall end. Now, some people say you could pray that the person dies, but more appropriate to pray that the suffering ends is what he was told to do. I don't know how he personally chose to go about it, but he told me about at least that. And what I found in the Tzitz Eliezer is a prayer which he says is the prayer of the Pachad Yitzchak, which is source number 13. It's the last source which I gave you, in which he says, he gives this prayer, that to pray, and I gave you the English translation, but I'll read in Hebrew. Ano Hashem b'koach rachamecha rabim uvorot chasadecha gdolim yihiru atzon milfanecha shetotzi mimasger asir nefesh ploni o plonis, that you should remove from the prison of the soul, so to speak, where the chained souls are found, the soul of this individual, v'totzi ehu miyisurin hey Rabbi Yemenu, you should remove the person from the suffering speedily in our day, v'aruach tashuv elo Elohim asher nitana, that, or asher nasana, and the spirit should return to the God that gave it. In other words, there is such a prayer, and it's not for the faint of heart to say, because it's very difficult to think, I'm praying that this person should die. Well, no, you're not praying that the person should die, but everybody's suffering. It's very difficult, and in a sense, you know, when somebody has been ill in that way, and when people say after the person is gone, the person is in a better place, that's when we truly believe that, and that's when we truly, I mean, you know, at least I don't know if we believe it, but it's comforting to us to believe that a person who is suffering in such a way, when they are no longer with us, when they have died, that they are in a better place. So if this prayer can help in whatever way, either bring it about that the suffering should end, or at least help us in our own minds that the suffering should end, then perhaps it is in merit to the individual, and that kind of prayer in that specific context is appropriate. So I want to get back to your question, because I was going to address this issue. So what about somebody who was sick and then has become better? So I think that you know, essentially the things which we've set up until now in this probably answer the question, in that we've said that, is the person sick now? So we could say a person who's in remission, so clearly they need to be guarded, they need to be watched, they need to be monitored. We want to see that the cancer, if that's what it is, doesn't come back. But are they sick now? No, they're not sick. They're clear. No, you go, you get your CAT scan, you get your MRI, whatever it is, and everything looks good. So if everything looks good, so the person right now isn't sick. Does that mean that that person should not go into a public mishabera for cholin? They're not sick. They're going about their lives. Does that mean that in your personal prayers you can't say, please God, protect this person so that it shouldn't come back? I think you absolutely can say that. I think it's very clear from the Gemara, it's very clear from the Rambam, that to pray that the zechus, that the merit of my tehillah, the merit of my prayers, the merit of the things which I learn, the merit of the things which I do, should protect somebody who is well, but who we know has a good chance, has, I shouldn't say good chance, has a chance of going into remission, of reverting back to that illness. So that type of prayer is appropriate. Okay, but to put that person in the Mishaberach is probably not appropriate. Okay, so now the last thing which I wanted to do before I open up the floor to questions, and I'm sorry I'm not going through the Shulchan Aruch. I don't want to scan it. You know, out of respect to you, I don't want to go through it. I mean, there's also a difference. I mean, I've noticed one word here, the Goses. So I'll talk about that for a moment. There are different categories of people who are ill. There's something called a chole, which we've talked about, and I hope that everybody understands what a chole is. There's a goses. Now, a goses is somebody who is literally on a deathbed at death's door. The doctors have said, this person is not getting up from here. They're going to die. Okay? Because everything indicates... Now, it's not what the doctors say, you got a 50-50 chance. That's not a goses. You are, you know, going to be dead. I don't know if it's 3 days. I don't know if it's a week. I mean, a goses, halachically, the actual definition is 3 days to live, but a person could hang on for a week, 2 weeks, you know.
Hospice.
Right, okay, hospice. So that person is a goses. So what about praying for a goses? So the person is considered alive, but again, in that type of circumstance, is it appropriate to say the person should have a refuah shleima? If there's a 50-50 chance, then the person's not a goses. If there's a 100% chance this person is going to be dying, then, you know, when doctors say you have 3 months to live, you're not a goses. Okay, because people who get 3 months to live, they've defied the medical books. That's fine. But if a person is circumstances which we're all familiar with, and it's not just that it doesn't look pretty. Everybody knows this person is going to go. That person is a ghost. So what prayer would be appropriate for that person? So perhaps that their suffering should end would be appropriate in that type of context. What about a shchiv mirah? A shchiv mirah is similar to a goses, somebody who is at death's door but is not going to die any minute. So, because there are also discussions about it. Matnas shchiv mirah. What does it mean if a person starts giving away their property, right, because they think they're going to die? It happens, and then the person gets better. So the question is: so obviously, a shchiv mirah, in other words, is not a goses because a shchiv mirah could get better. So the question that comes up, and again, this is the topic of a different discussion, is if a person gave away a present on account of the fact that they were a shchiv mirah, thought they were going to die, and then they get better. Now let's say a person, I'm making a $50,000 donation to such and such yeshiva because what do I need it for? I'm going to die. And then they get better, and all of a sudden, you know, I really need that money. So does the gift revert? So it's a topic of a different discussion, which is interesting, and maybe we'll talk about it a different time. But that's a classic rabbinic line, which we'll never talk about. But anyway, okay. But anyway, so a shchiv mirah. So is it appropriate to pray? So a shchiv mirah is somebody who could get better. So to put that person in a chola list, that would be appropriate. Okay. So the last thing which I wanted to say is that in sidurim, so I have a siddur, for example, which you know, in the back of many sidurim they have tehillim, or somewhere in the book they have tehillim. So if you read this stuff before or after the tehillim, many sidurim will have either suggestions of things that you should say. Different, like here I have a list of a bunch of different things. It says here, let's see. No, so the sitter will have different suggested paragraphs to say on account of different circumstances. So is it helpful? Yeah, I mean, look, David HaMelech, the reason why these paragraphs were composed was because David HaMelech was going through different difficult times in his life, and each difficult time, in whatever way, relates to something that we can relate to. And so the people who put the siddur together, based on whatever Masorah tradition that they had, they said, okay, these are good things to say. There are other things which are included here. I mean, on this particular page which I have, there's prayers, you know, to save a person from. Again, not to save a person from dying, and we're not going into the heebie-jeebie stuff, but to pray that our tehillim, or whatever it is that we're saying, should be as a merit to the individual. That's one idea. There's another type of prayer which is called the shinui shame, If a person is in dire straits, but at the same time, in other words, there is a chance that the person can get better if everything falls into place exactly the way the doctors are hoping that it will. So there is a concept of changing a person's name, saying, in which the text basically says that if it's been decreed in heaven that, let's say, Avram Yitzchak ben Sarah Rivka should die, well, we're going to ask that you'll add a name to the individual, say, well, we ask that the decree not be on, or we know that the decree hasn't been put on Avram Yitzchak Chaim ben Sarah Rivka, so now that we've changed his name, hopefully the decree will go on Avram Yitzchak, but Avram Yitzchak doesn't exist anymore. It's now Avram Yitzchak Chaim, and Avram Yitzchak Chaim should hopefully get better. So there is such a concept. I've been present at it a couple of times. I'm not going to say if it works. One of the individuals did die shortly thereafter. Another individual got better. So it's not. There are no rules which have guarantees in them. But as Jewish people and people of faith and people who believe in the power of tefillah, I cannot tell you how many times I've heard people say, look, the doctors have done all that they can and things look good or they look bad or whatever it may be. Now it's up to us. And what's up to us means that it's in our hands to move whatever we can in the heavens, so to speak, or in whatever way that God runs the world. God wants our prayers. We certainly hope that that's true, and we certainly believe that that's true. And in whatever manner that we can to help those individuals beyond, obviously, pursuing whatever medicine and medical care that the individuals should pursue to achieve those refuah shalemos, those complete healings and recoveries. Praying for the ill is something which we should, and I know we do, take seriously. And whatever manner we can pursue, see, do bikur cholim, visit those, check on them, see how they're doing, to move our own heartstrings to pray even more fervently on behalf of those who are ill. Hopefully, serve as the Gemara says, as a yagein aleihem, will protect them, and hopefully will help shorten the illnesses of those who we care for, and bring about refuah shleimus for those who are most needy of them. I'll open the floor for questions if anybody has. Yes.
My thought has been if someone is sick, I say a personal prayer with their name for Meshavir. But if someone is gravely ill, then say Tehillim. Is that?
So any formula is good. Misha Berach is basically saying let's throw it in there, and we're assuming that this person is going to be well, and we're putting it to the general, I guess, the mercy of the crowd who are there, saying, because we say in Misha Berach ba'avur shekolak alamis ba'alim ba'avuram, on behalf of the fact that everybody in this room is praying on their behalf. Okay, so I guess everybody's praying, generally speaking, that all those who are ill get better. But we're not necessarily thinking about those who are gravely ill, because we don't know your personal friend. We don't know X's, individual circumstance. We know, usually, we hope that the people who are ill. So I think that Tehillim is very powerful and can be very powerful. Again, like I said earlier, it's all about the mindset of the individual saying it. When you're thinking about that person and you're using the words which have been given to us, the Tehillim have been used for thousands of years for that purpose. And to think that Tehillim would serve any purpose beyond that, I'm saying that we say this is what Tehillim is for. So I think you're doing absolutely the right thing. You use Tehillim because those words are given to us. Yes?
I just want to make a quick plug for our Boy Engaged Tehillim group that we have.
I'm talking about 3 days to find Chabad. So I've been in places where if I've been visiting and I've gone up to make a Mishra for someone and I've had the question, are they in the hospital?
Mm-hmm.
As, I guess, a litmus test. If they're not in the hospital, how sick can they be?
Or keep it to yourself.
So did you come across any source that uses that, that they're admonished in the hospital confinement versus sick at home, as the Chayyim says. He doesn't specify, it says in bed.
I haven't. Look, to be quite honest, in the time of the Chayy Adam, who was going to a hospital?
Well, I'm talking about any...
Right, so I don't think that that's a fair litmus test. There are some people who say, I'm not going to a hospital. Or I can get the same care at home.
Right.
So I think that frankly, I think that for people to say that, they're being silly. You know, it's like, I like to ask the question, unrelated, you know, there's a great trivia question. Which was the first president of the United States who, as a baby, was born in a hospital? When he was a baby, before he became president, you know, when he was born.
Oh, he was born in a hospital?
The first one to be born in a hospital. They were all born at home.
Kennedy?
Nope, Kennedy was born at home. I actually was in the room where Kennedy was born. So were you. Actually, you should know that, Mr. Boston Man. Okay?
Beale Street.
Right? Anybody? Jimmy Carter. Jimmy Carter.
Okay? No, it's the first. We would have thought we were born at home.
We wish you were born at home, right? Jimmy Carter. No, so I'm saying, in other words, people. Hospitals are relatively new. I mean, at least in this manner. So for somebody to assume, you know, that is the person in a hospital? No, it's not that bad, but the person has, you know, an ill. So, but, you know, but that's why we have this discussion, so that we can understand what the criteria are. You know, like I said before, if a person is just walking around the house and they're just not going out, look, I'm contagious, but I'm on meds. So, I'm on the antibiotics. So, hey, you're on antibiotics. You're going to get better. Thank God. I mean, there's science has basically shown us that a person who has such and such illness and has such and such antibiotic has a 99.9% chance of getting better. So, then you're right. That person shouldn't be getting a Mishaberach right now. But if they're confined to a bed and they have to be at home, you know, that's something else.
But two things. I'm picking up on what you just said. I mean, you gave an example before. Anything untreated, you know, that will lead to you know, somebody's passing, you know, you should say Mishaberach. Antibiotics, you know, are a way of treatment. Anybody that has an infection, if it's not treated, it could lead to death.
Right. So,
conventional medicine, yes, 99.9%. But one thing I think we're seeing through here is this whole sense of litmus test or threshold of, you know, where someone is on the scale. I mean, you gave an example before of, 50-50 chance they'll be fine, that they're not a ghost system, in those, more stricter categories. But then you went right to 100% chance they're going to die. I mean, where's 90% fit? I mean, at what point,
No, so I think 90% chance that they'll die, you mean?
Yeah, or 75%. I mean,
Somewhere between 50. Okay, in other words, the between 50 and 100 where the better chance is that they won't get better. Right? Is that what you're saying? I would say it depends on looking at the person's circumstance. Can we pray? We can always pray that the person that God should have mercy on the person, and the person should get better. The Mishaberach versus praying on the person's behalf is just a fine detail in terms of like a Tircha de Tzibura question. Again, that's my opinion. Whether it's appropriate to include that person in a public Mishaberach. Okay, and that's why I said at the outset, I'm not sure if you were here at that moment, that I think a public, I think, again, this is a personal opinion, a public Mishaberach where names are announced in a shul should be confined to the members of that shul who are in such a circumstance. And then it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter if the person's 30%, like 70% chance that they'll get better, 50% chance that they'll get better, 25% chance that they'll get better, 5% chance that they'll get better. Okay, we all know the individual. We want to pray on that person's behalf.
Mishaberach. I mean, there seems to be the fundamental.
No, I'm saying again. That's just my personal thing on account of having been in a shul when they're reading 100 names and you're just sitting there going, when is this going to end? Because I don't know anybody who they're talking about. And while I care of that, while I care for them because they're members of Am Yisrael, I really don't want to be sitting through this. And that's just human nature, and maybe it's my weakness.
No, it's
but I think that a lot of people feel that way because I watch, I look around the room, and people go, right, exactly. But if it's members, if it's people who everybody knows, then it becomes real, and that's what I think is what we're trying to get to.
Getting back to that whole, threshold. I mean, at what point do you not say Mishaberach for somebody? I mean, Gosa is obviously, it seems to be fairly clear. But, you know, if they have a 20% chance, and you know, what's the time frame? It seems like, I mean, we're getting into like
a so this prognosis. So I mean, I can't give you a definite thing. I mean, this is for me that becomes the distinction between when do you do it publicly and when do you do it privately. So privately is always appropriate.
Right. Yeah.
Okay, but that I think is that distinction. That's why I said it's my opinion, you know, and where that lands. And that's why I think that once you're following the criteria of what's going to be done publicly, and publicly is based on the fact that everybody in the room, or just about everybody in the room, knows who we're talking about, then it doesn't become a problem anymore. And if everybody knows that so-and-so has a cold, he has a cold, he's going to be fine. So don't include the Mishbera. If everybody knows that so-and-so is in a hospital, is at death's door, has a disease, is having heart surgery, is going through a procedure that we all know is a serious procedure, or potentially serious procedure, then we do it publicly. Privately, we should all be doing it anyway. Okay, but again, only for somebody who is beyond like the cold cough circumstance, or you know, we could put somebody in antibiotics, but then you'll hear, oh, the person hasn't responded to the antibiotics. Well, then what? So obviously, it's a little more serious than just, you know, I had bronchitis and I'm a young man, and thank God bronchitis with penicillin is going to be fine. So I wouldn't put myself on a HOLA list if I get bronchitis and I get the proper treatment and I'm antibiotics, because thank God my track record has always been that it goes away in a couple of days. But if I, you know, if I, Khalila, had some sort of circumstance where it's not as, you know, yeah, I mean, it's been proven that, or it's been shown that such and such an antibiotic works, but it's not definite, it's not always, then we're at the other stage, even if it seems to be routine. Okay? All right. Thank you. May all sick people have refuah. Yes, ma'am.
Because today was Rosh Chodesh, and the women were just talking about staying at home at night during the day, and it became a little bit of a debate. Is there anything?
What?
The debate was staying there till Hillam at night versus staying it during the day. There was some people that were arguing that, from what they understood, you were not supposed to stay it at night. Other people saying it doesn't matter. So, other people argue that the night is really the beginning of the day.
Right. So I'm talking without 100% knowledge.
Okay.
I think that tefillah at any time is good and appropriate. So the thing which they may be talking about is a discussion. There is a discussion about whether people, I may be totally off here, but there is a discussion about whether people should, what they should be reciting at night or learning at night. There's a discussion that focuses on not doing Torah Shebichsav at night, or not that this is Torah, I'm saying, you know, like Tanakh, because it's written down, and written down, it's not good for the eye. Nowadays, it's irrelevant, because we have electric lighting. I think it's irrelevant, even though people say, oh, it's Gemara, it's Halacha. I think you can learn whatever you want now, because we have good lighting. But the point was that nighttime learning, because you can't read, because you're going to do a light of a candle, it's not good for your eyes, you should focus on Torah Shebaal Peh, which you're doing by heart anyway. So if that's where it comes from, then that's the discussion. I would say nowadays, irrelevant. You're going to do kill him, you could do it whenever. I mean, and if I'm wrong, I apologize. But I think
my
it's okay.
My daughter once mentioned that to me also.
I don't know. If you get news that so and so is having emergency surgery at 11 p.m. and you can gather at 11 p.m. to say Tehillim, I say you better gather at 11 p.m. and say your Tehillim. I don't care that it's nighttime.